Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a very special guest, someone we've been wanting to get for a long time. An expert on the economy, on economics, and also an expert on Latin American politics and what's taking place there. So he'll be here to talk to us about the state of the economy, about what's going on in Latin America, and about media coverage of both the economy and Latin America. So please join us today in Media Matters with our guest, Mark Weisbrot. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
There are some scary new developments in the ongoing controversy over government information manipulation. A Pentagon document declassified last month, signed by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, provides additional insight into the military's propaganda efforts. It admits that propaganda intended for international consumption is increasingly leaking back into the United States thanks to the Internet. And the document, called the Information Operations Roadmap, mentions the existence of several websites that have been set up by the U.S. government for propaganda purposes but display no evidence of their origin. It also hints that the Pentagon's campaign to plant stories in Iraqi media runs afoul of U.S. law. More has come to light about the Iraq initiative itself. The $100 million five-year contract between the Pentagon and the Lincoln Group is now publicly available thanks to a Freedom of Information Act request. It's surprisingly vague, allowing government propagandists for hire, quote, maximum flexibility, end quote, to produce and distribute their fake news, up to and including the use of deception as necessary. It also suggests the campaign extends far beyond the bounds of Iraq. Back at home, some startling revelations about the government's plans for the media in the event of a national emergency. In 2002, the White House promulgated executive orders leading to the creation of the Northern Command for National Defense, the first military command exclusively devoted to domestic operations. While the Bush administration drew partly on emergency orders first penned by President Reagan to create this system, it reportedly added some provisions of serious concern. One of them gives the president the authority to use the military to seize control of radio and TV stations. That's an overly drastic option to contemplate, as licensed broadcasters are already obligated to participate in the National Emergency Alert System and are required by law to relay all presidential messages in a time of national crisis.
There's division in the ranks now among telephone companies over the concept of network neutrality. Phone giants, most notably AT&T, Bell South, and Verizon, believe they should get paid not only for providing a connection to the Internet, but also for carrying content across their networks. This would fundamentally change the conditions under which the Internet has flourished and opens up the specter of data discrimination based on an online speaker's ability to pay. Now, it would seem that Verizon is backpedaling on its ambitions to put toll booths on Internet traffic, claiming it would rather work to develop a voluntary framework governing data discrimination instead of asking Congress to endorse or disregard the principle. Documents filed with the FCC explain why Verizon may be concerned about net neutrality. It's reserving more than 80% of the capacity of its new fiber optic network to offer television services, leaving very little overhead for web browsing and email. AT&T, however, has reiterated its commitment to squeeze online content providers for extra cash. And while both companies claim they just want fair compensation for the use of their networks, they're not exactly starved for cash. Last year, AT&T reported a $4.8 billion profit, while Verizon raked in $7.4 billion.
CNN is taking steps to look and sound more like Fox News. The networks hired two right-wing commentators to host new shows. The first is Glenn Beck, who last September disparaged both the victims of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks and those displaced by Hurricane Katrina.
When I see, 9/11 victim family, on television or whatever, I'm just like, oh, shut up. I'm so sick of them because they're always complaining, and we did our best for them. But the second thought that I had when I saw these people and they had to shut down the Astrodome and lock it down, I thought, I didn't think I could hate victims faster than the 9/11 victims.
Beck also coordinated pro-war rallies for America in the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. The second new face at CNN is William Bennett, a high-stakes gambler who's found fame and fortune writing and talking about morality.
I do know that it's true that if you wanted to reduce crime, if that were your sole purpose, you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down. That would be an impossible, ridiculous, and morally reprehensible thing to do, but your crime rate would go down.
William Bennett just ended a stint as a pundit for Fox and replaces columnist Robert Novak, who left CNN for Fox earlier this year. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you here on WILL, AM 580, in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, home of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and I'm coming to you from Campbell Hall. Today is February 5th, 2006. My producer, Andrea Boyle, technical director, Brett Polson. Today we have as our guest one of the leading popular economists in the United States, Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Mark Weisbrot earned his PhD in economics at the University of Michigan, and he's the co-author of Dean Baker, of Social Security, The Phony Crisis, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2000. But Mark Weisbrot's a lot more than simply a popular economist. He's also a journalist, a columnist who has a column on economic and policy issues that's distributed to over 550 daily newspapers by the Knight Ridder Tribune Information Services. His pieces have appeared widely in the Washington Post, LA Times, Boston Globe. And he is also extraordinarily conversant on Latin American politics. So it is a great pleasure to welcome again back to Media Matters, Mark Weisbrot. Mark?
Thanks, Bob.
Well, it's terrific to have you on the air with us. Now, let me clarify. Do you have some Champaign-Urbana roots in your background?
Sure. I went to undergrad school there, and I also lived there for a while when I was teaching at Eastern Illinois University for a bit.
Oh, terrific. I thought that was the situation. And, Mark, you just returned, if I'm not mistaken, from Venezuela, from the World Social Forum?
Yes.
Could you, I mean, I think a lot of our listeners have heard about it, and probably a lot of them haven't, for that matter. Could you talk a little bit about what the World Social Forum is, why it took place in Venezuela, and what it was like to be there and what you experienced?
Well, the Social Forum was set up some years ago. I can't remember the first starting year. Early, maybe 2000, maybe earlier than that. It was set up as an alternative to the World Economic Forum, which is held, and so it's held at roughly the same time in January, the one in Davos, where basically in Davos you have kind of a meeting of the world's elite. Politicians and business people who kind of talk about, you know, their plans for the world. And so a lot of the kind of social movements around the world decided at some point they needed something that was more concerned with the needs of the majority of people. And they, you know, their slogan is Another World is Possible. So it attracts a lot of people who are, you know, part of the left, and want to talk about alternatives.
And what was the one in Venezuela? How many people came? What was the tenor of it? What were the issues being covered?
Well, I saw different numbers, but I think there were at least somewhere around 100,000. You know, this wasn't the only venue. They used to have them just in Porto Alegre, and then they started to spread them around the world some. So this one was combined with... There was one in Africa and one in Asia as well, I believe. So, there were a lot of, you know, it's kind of a gathering where people get to talk about economic issues, political issues. And I think one of the big things was, you know, that it was in Venezuela, was important because most people don't know anything about Venezuela at all, even, you know, because the media coverage is so terrible.
Most Americans, you mean?
Yeah, but, you know, an interesting thing. The European and Brazilian and a lot of the other Latin American countries' coverage is actually worse than that of the United States.
That's quite a strong statement based on what we know of U.S. coverage.
Yeah, but it's a lot worse.
And how so? I mean, just for what is how would you
well,
characterize?
Well, I'll give you an example. On December 4th, Venezuela had elections for Congress, and the opposition decided to boycott those elections after realizing that they would, you know, only get about 30% of the Congress. And the Organization of American States, on the week before the election, so the Sunday before, issued a statement saying basically that, well, the opposition made these demands and said they would participate if these demands were met. And these demands have been met, so we expect that they will participate, and the election is, you know, it looks clean. And, of course, it is. It's a very transparent process there, much, much more than the United States, for example. And so you know, it was a deliberate attempt to delegitimize the election because the opposition knew they were going to lose. And the international press reported it kind of from the point of view of the opposition. For many days, they didn't even report the OAS statement, and they didn't, you know, they actually reported that the withdrawal of the opposition cast doubt on the legitimacy of the election, when this was all a very transparent move. Now, the reason I bring this up is because I think the European and the Brazilian press were worse. You know, the U.S. press eventually did catch on, and under a lot of pressure, they started to report more accurately what was happening. You know, that it was just a boycott because these people were going to lose.
Well, Mark Weisbart, why don't we return for a second? I do want to talk at some length about Venezuela specifically, the Chavez regime, press coverage of it, and sort of the Chavez model, what it might mean for Latin America. But let's just go back and close up talk about the World Social Forum for a second. Again, you know, what sort of stuff is being covered there? What comes out of something like this? And then how do people? What sort of coverage is it getting in the U.S. news media?
Well, I didn't follow all the coverage here. But it didn't get as much, you know, some of them get more than others, some of these social forums. You know, I think when globalization was, you know, more of a big topic in the media, they would report on Davos and then report on this and kind of contrast the two forums, and they don't cover it all that much now. But I think, you know, there are a lot of things where, for example, you have the WTO negotiations recently, and people are trying, you know, various civil society groups are trying to influence that, and they have, that's a very an effort that requires a lot of coordination from all over the world. So you see, one of the things you saw, there was a lot of groups meeting, talking about that, what to do next after the Hong Kong ministerial. So a lot of very practical stuff goes on there, aside from the workshops that talk about, you know, things like the future of socialism and things like that.
Our guest today, Mark Weisbrot, here in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Mark Weisbrot is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, based, I believe, in Washington. Is that right, Mark?
Yes.
And Mark Weisbrot is also a columnist on economic and policy issues for a column distributed by Knight Ridder Tribune Information Services. Appears all over the place, people. If you go and Google the name Weisbrot, W-E-I-S-B-R-O-T, you will come across a cornucopia of material written by Mark on economic issues, on Latin American politics. Venezuela, you've written about a lot, along with Haiti and a number of other locales in Latin America. Just a couple of weeks ago, Tom Friedman, in his op-ed column in the New York Times, was talking, making the case for energy conservation in the United States and less reliance on oil. And one of the main arguments he made was that the current countries that enjoy large amounts of oil and get the benefits of the United States using so much oil include a lot of rogue states that are anti-democratic and really threats to the world. And he listed among them, the two or three he listed, was Venezuela. And I thought this was sort of an interesting inclusion on his list as sort of an anti-democratic force, because as I understood it, it was actually a constitutional republic with a democratic government. Can you talk a little bit about, and I think some of our listeners are familiar with this, summer, what is going on with Venezuela? Why is it on that list?
Yeah, you have a problem there. You know, some people are completely ignorant. You know, I think a lot of people who say these things about Venezuela, just they don't know anything more about Venezuela than they know about Burkina Faso. You know, and Friedman could be in that category. It's hard to say. I mean, he's never written anything. There's no indication whether he knows anything. But really, the whole idea of Venezuela as undemocratic is absurd. All you have to do is go there, and you turn on the TV, you see the most oppositional media in the world, probably. Even in Europe, they wouldn't allow the media to take an oppositional role that this one takes, calling for the overthrow of the government during the oil strike, for example, of December 2002 to February 2003, every day. And in fact, that was after they already had a military coup, which ousted the government for 48 hours in April of 2002, that was actually led by the private media there. And still no censorship. There's never been any censorship of the press in Venezuela. The elections, as I said, are much more transparent and much cleaner than here. They have international observers, and the OAS and the Carter Center have repeatedly, and the European Union in the latest election, repeatedly certified the results. So they have problems like the rest of Latin America with the rule of law. There's a lot of impunity. People are not punished. But ironically, the worst political repression in the country is really against the pro-government organizers in the countryside, who are organizing for under the land reform laws. They get shot by paid assassins, and the state doesn't have the capacity to prosecute the murderers. And so you do see things like that, but that's something that's common in all Latin America. You don't see governmental repression like you have, the Peruvian government shuts down TV stations, for example. Venezuela's never done that, or the journalists are murdered in Mexico when they expose corruption in the government. That doesn't happen in Venezuela. So by any comparison, if you compare them to other countries of similar income levels, if you compare the Venezuela to the prior governments there, it clearly comes off better and more democratic. It's a very open society, and it's a kind of a weak state, actually, is more the problem than a strong one or an authoritarian one. And anybody who knows anything about Venezuela is being honest about it will tell you that. And you do have a big campaign here to try and make it look differently. But again, that just is playing upon people's ignorance.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in D.C., a newspaper columnist in economic and policy issues. We're talking about Latin America, what's going on there. We're also going to turn later in the program to talking about economics here in the United States and how the news media cover them and what the key issues are. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And, I'd want to remind our listeners that next week we have a special two-hour version of Media Matters from noon to 2 Central Time. And as our guest, we will have our perennial favorite, John Nichols, joining us to talk about the state of politics in the United States and the world today, all the breaking stories that John's been covering as a political columnist. 3 weeks from today, we'll have Noam Chomsky on a show I know a lot of our listeners have been looking forward to. We've got a lot of other terrific shows scheduled in the coming months, including Amy Goodman, although the date is not yet confirmed. So we have today, though, Mark Weisbrot. We're talking about Venezuela, the Chavez regime. You're talking about how there's a campaign against the Chavez regime here. I mean, What is Chavez doing that seems to create such concern in America? Let me ask this a different way, if I can, Mark. Let me put it in sort of, this is going to sound naive, but I mean, the United States is fighting wars ostensibly for self-determination and democracy and to get rid of authoritarian and awful regimes around the world. As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, the Chavez regime has been elected several times in fair elections and actually has a degree of popular support that's unusual for elected governments in the world, especially in Latin America. Why aren't we embracing this regime is exactly what we're fighting for.
Well, you know, the point you made, it was good that you brought up the Friedman column because I think it shows something. Oil is a big thing, and I think this is a mistake that is made across the political spectrum from left to right. They often think that our wars and interventions are about oil, per se, like in Iran. Iran is going to be the next confrontation, not necessarily a war, but Iraq, for example. And it's not really oil, per se, because we're always going to get the oil. No matter who controls Iraq, Iran, or Saudi Arabia, they're going to sell the oil on the world market, and we'll always get it. And it's the control over oil that means power. And you can see this very clearly with the case of Venezuela, because here you have a government that is no longer under the control of the United States. And they have oil, which is now selling at $65 a barrel. And as a result, this government and Chavez himself has become the most influential person in the Americas after George W. Bush, and in fact, more influential in most of Latin America. So they've committed $2.4 billion of lending to Argentina in the last year, and that was what partially enabled Argentina to pay off the IMF and never have to listen to their policy prescriptions, which were, as you probably know, disastrous for them. They're giving discounted oil to the CARICOM countries.
Now, what does CARICOM mean?
The Caribbean, the countries in the Caribbean.
Okay.
And now Evo Morales has been elected, and so
that's in Bolivia.
In Bolivia, and this is, I think, most people don't understand it. The journalists haven't figured this out yet because they don't do arithmetic very well. But this is a whole new ball game in Latin America. You now have the leader of a small, poorest country in South America, highly indebted country, and has been elected, and he is going to face the international financial institutions of the United States in a very strong bargaining position because he doesn't need them at all. Chavez could pay off his entire foreign debt out of reserves without batting an eye, and in fact will do so if necessary. So, you see, it's totally changed the shape and the history of South America. And this is an example of what happens, what can happen when the United States loses control over an oil-producing country with a government that wants to promote positive social change, in this case, in the Western Hemisphere.
So your point is that it's not about actually having access to the oil. That's going to come through the world market, but it's having control over the great money that comes from having access to the oil.
Yeah, and an independent source of power.
And so if I can put words in your mouth, Mark Weisbrot, I mean, it strikes me what you're describing is the situation back in the old Soviet Union days where third world nations like India, and you saw this across Asia and Africa, would play the Soviets off against the United States and bargain for better deals for whoever they gave their alliance to. And after the decline of the collapse of the Soviet Union, they didn't have anyone to bargain with, so the United States had a lot more power and leverage. And now that's changing again.
Yeah, it's really Latin America is a different world today. You know, 5 or 6 years ago, I would have said, if Evo Morales were elected in Bolivia, I would have said he wouldn't have a chance. They would have strangled the country economically like they did to Haiti and either overthrown the government or forced the government to really basically go back on most of its or all of its promises.
Our guest today in Media Matters, Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, frequent newspaper columnist on economic and policy issues, writes widely on Latin America, including Haiti, a major piece recently in The Nation, which I want to get to later as well. But there's a wealth of topics we can talk about with Mark Weisbrot, so please call in at 333-9455 if you have any questions or comments. And toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines if we can right now, or go to them for the first time. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Bob.
Hey.
Hi, everybody. I wanted to tell people, for the local listeners, there is a Citgo on North Market in 57, so if people want to buy Venezuelan state-owned oil, they can do it. It's the only, I've heard it called by, I think, Naomi Klein. It's the only place in the world where oil wealth is actually being distributed to the poor. I wanted to congratulate you, Mark, for how how good you were on NewsHour when you were paired with Noriega, the guy that was probably the engineer of the coup in Haiti, the most recent one, and probably had his hand in some. He's now not in the State Department. I guess they didn't send any. That was, I guess, commenting on Morales. But what I really wanted to ask about was both Argentina and Brazil seem to have paid off their IMF loans, and it seems to have sort of disrupted the, I heard on the BBC that it disrupted the business plan that the IMF is actually sort of, since they don't have that interest coming in, they actually are having some kind of short-term cash flow problems, which is just something clever. I wanted to point it out. It's nice to applaud. But what the bigger point is that, is there any chance? I asked a colleague of yours if Lula is going to get structural adjustment off of his back, is there any chance that he might actually redeem some of the promises that he's made? There's a lot of disappointment in Brazil, and we have this turn to a center left that's going on in Latin America, but the constraints are still palpable on Brazil, despite the fact that they may not have the IMF so directly on their back. So I'll hang up and listen to your response to that. Thanks.
Thank you for that. And Mark, if I can ask you before you answer that, because it's a great question that the caller has about Brazil, can you give a little background on Lula in Brazil? Because I suspect some of our listeners aren't really up to speed on what's going on in Brazil.
Sure. Well, Lula da Silva was elected in 2002 in Brazil with a program that promised it was the Workers' Party, which had been struggling for 21 years or so to get to this stage, and it was a very historic victory in the sense he was a worker. He represented the left party in Brazil.
And if I can just interject one thing for listeners, Brazil is almost the polar opposite of Bolivia in the sense that it's, 180 million people? It's an enormous country, one of the largest in the world, with a very developed and advanced economy in portions of the country. I mean, it is not an entirely impoverished country, although it enjoys or experiences spectacular inequality.
That's right. It has the worst inequality in the entire world. And, of course, Latin America has the worst inequality as a region. And so he did promise a number of things to do something about it, to change the policies, to break with neoliberal policies. And, you know, Brazil for 25 years now, by the way, has had a growth rate of 0.5% annually in terms of per capita income. So really, you know, terrible performance. And, you know, prior to 1980, from, say, 60 to 80, it grew. It was one of the fastest growing countries in the world. And, in fact, they would have, European living standards today if they had just continued to grow at that rate. So Lula was one of several presidents that was elected on an anti-neoliberal, what Latin Americans call neoliberal, which represents the Washington consensus reforms over the last 25 years. And, in fact, the other parties also ran against the neoliberal program, even the incumbent party that had implemented these reforms for 8 years. And so, unfortunately, the government did not break with any of the neoliberal policies of the previous regime. And as a result, you don't have really much to show in terms of economic gains. And the economy is actually going into a recession right now. One of the biggest problems is the high interest rates. Interest rates are almost 18% still. If you can imagine what that's like, the overnight central bank rate, you know, compared to our 4.5% here in the U.S. This was part of the neoliberal program that they had hoped to break with, or the party had hoped to break with. So the question that the caller is asking is, what will happen now that they're free from the IMF? And I wish I could be optimistic for the short run, but the fact is the IMF, they didn't have an IMF program. They paid off the IMF what was it? It was around $15 billion, I think. It was huge. At the end of the last year, December. And they didn't have a program, so they really weren't subject to IMF pressures. What they have, I guess, I just returned from there and talked to a lot of people there, and they have basically a struggle within their own elite and within their political parties between a section that really wants, and if I could just summarize it, that is very much cares about the financial class, or is in his
the life. Bankers, in other words,
the bankers, the big creditors, and the international financial markets. And, you know, they want to keep the current neoliberal policies, the high budget, primary budget surplus, the high interest rates, and the other neoliberal policies, such as avoiding any kind of industrial or development strategy that's been successful in the past. And then you have a kind of a developmentalist wing, and you have this within each of the three major political parties, and you have it within all institutions. In fact, the military, interestingly enough, is very pro-development. They're the most pro-development part of the society in terms of big institutions. And right now, the part that's concerned with the financial class has the upper hand. I do think it will change, regardless of who is elected in October. They have another election. And Lula could still win, although he was weakened by a big corruption scandal over the last year. But, and, you know, the media has an enormous role there, too. Again, it's like here, only I would say a little bit worse, in the sense that, you know, when the economy starts to go south here, there's a part of the business press that really reports it. And there you really have the media is so supportive of the government and its economic positions that most people don't really get to even see the view that maybe they've done the wrong thing.
Are they supportive of the government because it's a government-controlled press, even by Lula, or are they supportive of just a very pro-business policies?
It's a pro-business, pro-financial kind of pro-financial class kind of media.
Okay, we're talking to Mark Weisbrot. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Hi, thanks for the program. Sometimes it's, or maybe one should say often, reported in the media that the government in Venezuela came in with all these promises of helping the poor, but now there are more poor people in Venezuela than ever or than before Chavez. I wondered if you wanted to comment on that.
Yes.
Sure. Well, you know, that was a campaign here for a while to try, and the State Department started saying it, and, you know, that poverty had actually worsened. And that was based, and, you know, the Washington Post actually had an editorial just a week or so ago, and it was cleverly worded because they, you know, I've pointed this out to them several times. So this time they said during his first 6 years in office, the poverty rate went from 43 to 53%. Well, that's almost true in the sense that they're taking a poverty rate that was based on the first quarter of last year, which was really a result of the oil strike of 2002-2003. So poverty rates are very sensitive to growth rates. They move up and down when the economy goes into a deep recession and when it recovers. But the bottom line is the poverty rate today is about 37%, so it is noticeably lower than when Chavez took office. But more importantly, even more importantly, that poverty rate does not even take into account that roughly 70% of the population has health care and 50% has subsidized food. So if you took into account those changes in the non-cash income,
what they call the social wage?
Yeah, I would just call it the non-cash income of the poor. You know, just imagine the United States if you got rid of Medicaid, you know, the health care program we have for poor people, and food stamps. Well, you know, nobody would claim that the poor were no worse off, even though their cash income was the same. So you have the, you know, in reverse in Venezuela, you have the reverse situation. Poor people have access to health care and cheap food.
Now, is this unusual? Now, Mark, is this something that's done across Latin America? Is Venezuela really pretty much the only country that has these sorts of
programs? Oh, no, this is completely, this is, well, I shouldn't say it's completely unprecedented. You have some health care systems, national health care systems in various countries, but this was a drastic change for Venezuela.
And it's come under the Chavez regime or government?
Yeah, all just in the last few years.
Well, let's go back to the phone line. Well, one last thing before I get back to the phone lines on this point. I mean, you mentioned earlier discussions about socialism. Is Chavez a socialist? Is he, and by socialist, I don't just mean the social democratic sense of Sweden or Norway or the Labour Party at one point in Britain of having social policies, but having a primarily private sector-driven economy, but actually a genuine socialist, where he ultimately sees a collective nonprofit institutions guiding the economy?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you'd have to ask him, probably, but he does call himself a socialist, and he's talking more and more in the last year or so about socialism and trying to define it in some ways. I mean, he said very clearly that, you know, Venezuela is not going to be like Cuba, for example, and it is very much a democratic society, as I pointed out. But he does seem to be talking about it more. But I think, you know, he calls it 21st century socialism. But they're gradually approaching anything like that. I mean, I guess, you know, the private sector is still a larger share of the economy than it was before he took office. So the state has not expanded greatly. And they do have a lot of cooperatives. Close to 1.5% of the labor force is now in cooperatives, and a lot of those are worker managed. And so there's experimentation, but it's gradual. And they recognize that the state, which was inherited from the past, is just still has nowhere near the capacity to engage in radical economy-wide reforms.
Mark Weisfeld, we have several patient callers waiting to talk to you, but I want to wrap this up before we get back to them, because this is a point I wanted to make sure we get to in the program today. You talked earlier about the private, commercially driven media system in Venezuela as being hostile to the Chavez government in a way that few Americans could possibly imagine, and everything I've read suggested it might be the most, you know, critical or biased press in the world. What has the Chavez government done? Have there been efforts to try to establish some sort of countervailing media system that's not owned by a handful of wealthy families in that country?
Yes, they actually do have two state TV channels. And when I was there not too long ago, and they played Outfoxed, translated the movie, the documentary, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and other interesting things. So they have two state TV channels. They don't have anywhere near the audience the private does, but it's quite, you know, it's quite large and it's growing, and that's been their response. I mean, the Congress also did pass a media law, which regulates the media somewhat. And this is where they came under criticism from, you know, human rights groups here, for example. And I think the law does have some vaguely worded portions in it, which I would object to as well. But so far, it hasn't really been used to censor the media.
We've got Mark Weisbrod on there. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. We've got a good 20 minutes or so left in the show. We've got some very patient callers. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Mark Weisbrod.
To what extent does the war on drugs fuel anti-American sentiment in Latin America? I speak specifically of spraying the cocoa crops in order to eradicate them. I understand that sometimes they spray food crops and sometimes they poison the water tables. I'll hang up. Thank you.
Thank you. And I guess that refers to the entire Andean countries.
Yeah, and that's certainly, I mean, the caller partly answered the question. And people, there's enormous resentment throughout the region over this. And in fact, you know, that's been kind of the foreign policy of the United States for several years now. It's all drugs and terrorism. And you can imagine that it doesn't make us very popular. It's one of the things that contributed to the United States being really at a low point probably since World War II in its relations with Latin America. And it's going to be a big point of friction between Evo Morales' new government, and the United States, because he's declared that coca growing will be completely legal and is refusing to, I mean, he is refusing to cooperate in any eradication efforts, although he has said very clearly that he will go after drug traffickers.
And, you know, while we're talking about the Andean countries, at the very bottom of the Andean mountain range is Chile on the Pacific coast, and it just recently had its own national elections. Chile has held up oftentimes is sort of the success, the one success story for neoliberal policies in Latin America, the one place where sort of turning everything over to the profit motive has produced strong economic growth and rising incomes. Is this an accurate way to present the story of Chile over the past 20 years? And what's going on there, to your knowledge?
Well, it's a bit exaggerated. First, you have to understand, I should have made this point earlier since we're talking about Latin America. The number one thing that people should know, if they only know one fact about the last 25 years, it's been the worst economic performance in the modern history of Latin America. And that's not by measures of inequality or poverty. That's just economic growth. And it's very important because, you know, most of the criticism is about poverty and inequality, but those have not gotten remarkably worse over the last 25 years under neoliberalism. What's happened is the reason, and the reason that poverty is so bad is because the economies have not, as a whole, have grown very much at all. You've had about 10% growth in income per person. That's the most basic measure that economists use to judge the performance of the economy. So income per person has grown about 10% in the last 25 years. Now, you compare that to a shorter period, just 1960 to 1980, the 20 years prior, and it grew by 82%. So this is a huge failure, and it's not recognized enough. And so with regard to Chile, Chile is the only country in the region that actually grew faster. I guess I could say the hemisphere, because you could include the U.S. too, that actually has grown faster since 1980 than it did before. And so it is often pointed to as the success story. And I think the neoliberal, calling it a neoliberal success story is a little bit of an exaggeration, because they're in some sense an exception that proved the rule. They had capital controls, that is, controls over, capital inflows. They were an important part of their strategy. They had a certain amount of planning in terms of their export strategy.
So the state played a larger role than just sort of turning things over to investors?
Yes, a little bit, and also they just weren't as neoliberal across the board. Their interest rates weren't as high, and they did have at least a large enough role. So it wasn't completely a neoliberal success story.
We're talking to Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research here in Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in, the phone number here, 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Lines are open. Let's go back to the phone lines right now, if we can. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Yes, thank you. Following on what you were just saying, I'd like you to speak a little more explicitly about the role of the IMF and the World Bank in increasing the immiseration of, you know, many, many people around the world. And I ask that question in light of reading John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, where, I mean, he pretty much lays out where his job was to make sure these countries got so deep into debt that they would have to do whatever the U.S. government and the corporations basically told them to do.
Yes, well, there's no doubt that the IMF and the World Bank and the regional banks, such as the Inter-American Development Bank, have been a very powerful force, I would say even more powerful than the Pentagon, in the last 25 years in terms of being an instrument of U.S. Foreign commercial policy and imposing or pressuring governments for various economic policies that turned out not to be in their interest. And among these are the neoliberal reforms, the massive privatizations. For example, in Latin America, you had $178 billion worth of privatization in the 90s, which was, 18 times more than you had even in the former Soviet Union. Not only that, but the high interest rates, the tight fiscal policies, sometimes even in recessions, the indiscriminate opening to trade and investment flows, a lot of policies that turned out to be a failure. And again, we haven't had really a debate in this country over what, you know, policies did what the contribution was to this economic failure. But clearly, some of these policies were terribly wrong. Now, I have to say, on an optimistic note, the IMF's power has been sharply reduced. And in fact, it's really just a shadow of its former self right now. It has.
What accounts for that, Mark?
Well, there are two things. You know, they screwed up so badly in the Asian crisis in the late 90s that the middle-income Asian countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, South Korea, all South Korea is actually high-income now, they all piled up reserves, enormous reserves, partly so they would never have to, foreign exchange reserves, so they would never have to go to the IMF again. And then you had the confrontation with Argentina where they defaulted on an enormous debt, a record sovereign debt default in the history of the world. They refused the IMF conditions, and they broke with the IMF, denounced them even, and they have had a remarkably fast and robust recovery. They've been growing at 9% annually for 3 years now. And so they pretty much showed, without getting a dime, as a matter of fact, from the IMF, the IMF actually drained about 4% of GDP out of there in 2002 when the economy was completely destroyed. So they really showed that you didn't need the IMF as long as you had a trade surplus. And I think the result of that is that, and I think one of your previous callers mentioned it too, there nobody wants to borrow from them anymore. And this was very important because the IMF money was never that important. It was the fact that they headed up this creditors cartel where if you didn't do what the IMF told you, you didn't get money from the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, and very often the private sector as well. And that was extremely powerful. And the whole thing was very concentrated because the U.S. Treasury Department controls the IMF, even though the Europeans and the Japanese could theoretically outvote them. They haven't done that in 60 years. So this was this very concentrated economic power in the U.S. Treasury Department, and it pretty much has disappeared for at least the middle-income countries, although the poorer countries are still subject to them.
Let's go back to the phone lines if we can now. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Mark Weisbrot.
Yeah, if you would like to comment on the our economy in terms of, you know, when do we have a day of reckoning in light of all these, you know, overspending and all that kind of thing. So anything to comment, I'll just go off the air.
Yeah, and that's a terrific question where I wanted to take the conversation next, so thank you very much, caller. You've written widely and studied the U.S. economy. You know, what is your assessment of the core structural state of the economy today and going forward? And at the end of that, Mark, if you talk a little bit about the press coverage and media coverage of the economy, so, you know, the stuff Americans have to work with to make sense of this.
Sure. Well, the U.S. economy faces some big structural imbalances right now, and the biggest one is a housing bubble. There's a bubble in house prices, probably about $5 trillion worth.
And what can you explain what that term bubble means?
It means that you've got asset prices that are inflated because of just kind of a psychological phenomenon where people buy houses because the price is going up, and then more people see that as a way to make money, so they buy houses, and that drives the price up. And so it's driven psychologically, and the asset values go beyond any realistic or sustainable levels. It's exactly what happened in the stock market in the late 90s and burst between 2000 and 2002 and caused the recession of 2001. Now, we recovered. That recession of 2001 could have been very bad as we lost, you know, $7 trillion of wealth in the stock market, and that has an enormous impact on the economy. But the thing that saved us from a severe recession, although you did have a recession with a terribly bad recovery with regard to employment, as you know, what saved us from worse fate was the housing bubble, which had already started, took off, and that created most of the jobs, directly or indirectly, has really created almost all the job creation we've had since 2001, since the recovery. And that's because people, when they buy houses or refinance their mortgages, they borrow. That borrowing has really, trillions of dollars of borrowing has really driven the economy since the last recession. And that will come to an end when the housing bubble bursts, which it's already starting to do in some
cities. Can we have a gradual slowdown, a soft landing, or does it have to be a collapse?
It's pretty even if the housing market slows gradually, so right now you have, cities where prices have stopped rising, San Francisco, Boston, they're actually falling. So, you could have the price collapse take place slowly, which I don't think it will, but let's say that it does. It doesn't really matter because you're still going to get a sharp decline in people borrow on their homes, right? These equity loans. And that decline in borrowing will be enough to tip the economy into a recession.
Mm-hmm.
So either way, you're almost certainly going to get a recession out of it.
Now, traditionally, as I understand economics, and you certainly can correct me if I've got this wrong, when an economy like ours goes into a recession, the way the government slows the recession and stimulates the economy is by going into deficit spending and throwing resources into commission. Is that what we'll do this time?
Probably. I mean, if it's, I hate to say this, but I think if it happens on the Republicans' watch, I think they'll use military spending, which they're already using quite a bit. It's up to about, including the war, it's about 5% of GDP now, which is, quite a big increase when it was a few years ago. I think, they're out of bubbles. I mean, it's hard to conceive of another bubble that would rescue the economy.
Well, the reason I asked that is I was trying to get the fact that we already have, really extraordinarily large deficits in a number of accounts, trade, balance of payments, really unprecedented in those cases, and also in just the U.S. federal deficit. I mean, haven't we used those options up already?
Well, not completely. The deficit... The annual deficit can get considerably or noticeably bigger. The big problem you have is more long term. You have a gross federal debt today. That would be the number I would look at, the actual debt as opposed to the annual deficit, the
mm-hmm.
stock of debt, is about 67% of GDP, so 67% of our economy. That's the proper way to look at it.
Mm-hmm. What was it, for example, just for our listeners' sake and my sake, 10 or 20 years ago?
This is close to a 50-year record, and for comparison, at the height of the Vietnam War, it was 43%, 43.5%, and falling, and now it's 67% and rising, and you have record low interest rates. So as the interest rates go up, this will also, the burden of this debt will get bigger. So we have a problem, and it's gonna, it's going to squeeze people. You can already see what they're doing. They're cutting Medicare and Medicaid and student loans. You just have to wonder how long people will take this. But I think that's the future, the near future.
So, if I can get back to the caller's question, what's your sense of where the U.S. economy is heading over the next few years? I mean, there's going to be a housing bubble collapse and. Do you think we have a period of growth in front of us or a recession?
No, I think that when the housing bubble goes, it will almost certainly cause a recession. It'll have the same, because it's as powerful at least as the stock market bubble in its effect on spending. You have another imbalance, which is which you mentioned, which is the trade deficit. That's being financed by the Asian central banks.
And we hear about this a lot. And you're an economist. Can you explain why that's important to the standard of living of Americans, and how this could really affect our lives in the next few years?
Well, there's two ways. First of all, the interest rates long-term rates could go up sharply. If there's a sell-off or a slowdown in the rate of buying of U.S. Treasuries, you see the foreign central banks are buying up dollars, Asian central banks, China, Japan, South Korea, and that's doing two things. One is it's keeping our currency high enough and so that our trade deficit doesn't adjust, but they're also buying U.S. Treasuries. And that actually, when you buy U.S. 10-year Treasury bonds, that actually pushes the interest rate on those bonds down. So that's what's keeping the long-term interest rate down. Now, if there's a flight from the dollar, you could see that interest rate go up, and that would burst a housing bubble. So that's the most immediate risk, because, as I said, the housing bubble is the most serious short-term immediate imbalance. But you do have another effect as well, and that is when the dollar falls, that's the way the trade deficit has to adjust. The dollar has to come down at some point.
So that means we can buy less goods over outside the United States than we could before. Our standard, so it's like a way prices go up for products that we bring in from outside the United States.
Exactly. And that means some reduction in U.S. living standards, not huge, but it also means an increase in the inflation rate, which, again, wouldn't be a big problem for me or you, but the central bank, and we have a new Fed chair, Ben Bernanke, who's, you know, going to have to prove himself. And so if he responds to this uptick in inflation by raising the short-term rates, you know, we could have an unnecessary slowing of the economy as well, in addition to the collapse of demand from the housing bubble. So these imbalances are all related, and they don't really paint a good picture of the short and intermediate future.
Mark Weisbrot, we have time for one more caller. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Spring Bay, if you could keep it brief, we'd appreciate it.
I sure will. There are some observers who talk in terms of defending the dollar in terms of making sure that the oil markets are still in dollar denominations rather than in euros, and that if Iran moved to set up a euro oil bourse, that could trigger some major economic problems. And wondering if you had any comments on that.
Okay, Mark.
Yeah, you hear that theory a lot. I'm afraid it's a little bit it's wrong. If say that the major oil producers decided to price oil in euros instead of dollars, that wouldn't really change anything because buyers would have to convert to euros in order to buy the oil, but then once the oil was bought, the country that was selling it would convert the euros back to dollars. So that by itself doesn't mean anything. Now, what really could mean something is if the major oil producers decided to hold more of their reserves in other currencies, euros or yen, instead of dollars. Now, that could, in fact, cause the dollar to fall, which, again, has to happen and is not necessarily a bad thing over the intermediate term for the U.S. economy. It should happen. It'll narrow our trade deficit, increase our exports, and reduce our imports.
Mark Weisbrot, unfortunately, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which is a sign that Travis Smiley is about to throw me out of the studio so he can do his show. Before we close, if people want to follow up on your writings and your work, is there a website they can go to?
Sure. It's CEPR. That's Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net.
And are you working on any books or articles that people should keep their eyes open for?
Well, most of what I write is going to be up on the web. I'm doing a little update on the Venezuelan economy now, and also something about Bolivia's debt, which should be up in the next week or so.
Well, Mark Weisbrot, thanks so much for joining us today in Media Matters. It's really been a pleasure having you.
Thanks, Bob. My pleasure.
And dear listeners, we'll be back in 166 hours on noon next week for a special two-hour version on politics today in the United States with my dear friend John Nichols. Stay tuned. I want to thank Andrew Boyle again, the producer, Brett Polson, technical director. My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, and see you next week.